This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. We're thrilled today to be joined by one of the most preeminent CEOs in the country. We've got Dr. Ken Davis, the CEO of the Mount Sinai Health System, with us on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. He'll talk to us about how Mount Sinai became one of the most elite systems in the country, what they're seeing with COVID, advice for leaders, and more. Dr. Davis, can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Hi. Well, I'm Ken Davis. I'm president and CEO of Mount Sinai Medical Center. I'm a psychiatrist by training who was basically a medical scientist doing research in brain diseases like schizophrenia and Alzheimer's. I was asked in around 2003 to step up and be the dean of our medical school, and about 10 weeks later asked to be the CEO and the dean, and I've been doing it ever since.
Let me talk to you for a moment about your background in psychiatry. You see so many leaders today that are providers by background, a lot of internists, a lot of surgeons that become CEOs of health systems. You also see more and more great nurse leaders become CEOs of health systems, people like Nancy Agee, people like Johnny Spiso, and a whole host of others. It's unusual that you see someone with a psychiatry background become the leader of a system. Can you talk about that as part of your background? And also, you were a very prolific leader in psychiatry and studies. Talk a little bit about your background and how that led you to leadership.
Well, I was always interested in the question of what's the biological basis of psychiatric disease. And when I began my career, psychoanalytic psychotherapy was the underlying science of psychiatric disease. And I couldn't believe that things like psychosis or bipolar disease could be the consequence of oral, anal, or phallic periods in one's life. I believed it had to be biological. And I was associated with some people then in my medical school who encouraged me to go in a laboratory and begin studying catecholamines. At that time, Julie Axelrod won a Nobel Prize for discovering the importance of neurotransmitters in the brain, and I thought this had to be what was going on. So I committed my career to that. And early on in my career, I got fascinated by the question of what did acetylcholine do in the brain, and began to read a lot about it and found out that in at least rats, it had something to do with learning and memory. So I did a very early study in which I gave young, normal, healthy Stanford undergraduates a drug that increased in acetylcholine, and lo and behold, they learned more words on a word-finding test that we did, and that led ultimately to my discovery of all the drugs that led to the Alzheimer's treatment regimens, all the cholinesterase inhibitors. So I had been very, very involved in the science of this, had a lot of grants, was a very successful chairman, and it wasn't surprising that when our deanship of our school opened up, that our search committee said, well, he'd be a very good dean. I mean, he understands science, he gets grants, he's hired good people, it's a good department, and he knows how to deal with a P&L in a department, so it made sense. Well, I didn't expect to be asked to then to be CEO, but we were in a lot of financial problems, and 10 weeks into my tenure, I was called into the chairman of the board's office, and the chairman of the board turns to me and he says, we're firing the CEO, we want you to do both jobs. I said, I'm really not trained in that kind of management. He said, we've been watching you, we know you can do it, this is the decision. And so I became the CEO by accident. I was the accidental CEO because the guy in front of me was failing and Mount Sinai was in a lot of trouble and the board wanted to move quickly. And I guess their judgment was right.
Well, I think the jury's out on whether the judgment was right or not. No, I'm just kidding. Dr. Davis, take a moment and talk about, you've led this amazing transformation of Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai, aside from its financial issues, came back to being successful financially, but also came back to being really viewed as, again, one of the elite systems in the country. Talk about how that happened, and the jury is not out. I mean, you've done right. A magnificent job, like an unparalleled job. Talk about how that happened, how you were able to sort of like re-energize, turn Mount Sinai around, and make it again listed as one of the top health systems in the country. How did this happen?
I surrounded myself with really good people. It was a humbling experience to be asked to also be the CEO. And I was kind of fortunate that at that point in my career, I felt internally that I had accomplished enough, published hundreds of papers, had lots of awards, was in the National Academy, that I didn't need to prove myself anymore. What I needed to do was find great people who really could lead along with me, and I could take, and I could step back. And I think it was the ability to find the best people, to give them free rein, challenge them with lofty goals that made it possible to bring on a management team that was really superior. For instance, the dean, Dennis Charney. I knew Dennis as a colleague in parallel, because he had a parallel career to mine, for decades. I knew ultimately Dennis could be a great dean. So I recruited him away from the NIMH, where he was the head of the largest lab there, said, you'll be associate dean for research for a couple of years, then you'll become the dean. And I knew that he could be great because he understood great science, and he had written a lot of grants when he was at Yale before he was the NIMH. I knew he had the capability to pick the right people and be a great leader. And I did the same thing with a lot of other departments and a lot of other my close management team. And we put together a great team that feels comfortable with each other. It may also be a part of me that was still influenced by the early part of my career in psychiatry, when I used to run groups. And group therapy teaches you a lot, particularly task-oriented group therapy, about what makes people work well together and function as a team and respect each other. There are certain personality types that just don't work, and I knew to stay away from them. And I also knew that the generation of leaders that I was inheriting that had brought Mount Sinai to problems had a lot of those problems, had a lot of those personality issues, and I had to let them go.
Can you take a moment on science-based background and how that science-based background and that rigor in science applies to business? I mean, some people would say they're very different, but when I listen to you, it seems like a very systematic approach to a lot of things with a lot of clarity of principles, and that led to success in science. It's led to success in business, as it will. I mean, business in running a major, major elite health system. Talk about parallels in science and business.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting story that brings that to the focus, brings that really to the forefront. The first day that I was CEO, we had a group that was consulting with Mount Sinai about how to deal with its fiscal problems. And that group makes a recommendation to me. And the recommendation was that we had to cut the FTEs that were all in the data management group of the CEO suite. And I looked at these people and I said, you got to be kidding. I'm a scientist. I need data. I want to know by DRG where all the margins are and where the negative margins are. I have to recruit doctors to turn us around, and I have to know what areas to recruit into. And you want to get rid of my data group? So that's the most important group that I have. Being a scientist, my orientation was, this has to be data-driven. So I didn't let that group go over the objections of the consultants. And lo and behold, they sat down with me, and what did they say? Things like, I read, you know, when I got the data, hey, I needed more vascular surgeons. I needed more orthopedic surgeons. We hardly had any. I mean, imagine a major medical center that wasn't doing major surgery in spines, hips, and knees. There's the margin. That wasn't doing enough vascular surgery. That wasn't doing enough cardiovascular surgery. And had most of its investment in low margin areas, because traditionally we were a hospital that took great pride in its internal medicine. But sadly, By the time I took over, the margins in internal medicine, particularly in a hospital that serves an underserved community like Harlem, was losing a ton of money that way. So I said, well, it's fine that we do that, but we have to add the right people. So I went to the board, took all the money that we had, an unrestricted endowment, and I used it to recruit high margin physicians, the kind of physicians that would be able to turn us around. That was all data driven. That came from a scientific background. That wasn't from intuition. That wasn't what somebody told me. That wasn't what I got from a webinar. You know, that was just data driven science.
Fascinating. And take a moment and talk about the things that you take great pride in at Mount Sinai today. What are two or three of the things that you look at and say, we take great pride in this, this, and that?
I take pride in the quality, our quality. I take pride in the complexity of patients that we take care of, the growth of those really unique areas like transplantation that we keep growing in like crazy, like cardiovascular disease. You know, I take a tremendous amount of pride in the fact that in any year, when you look at medical schools that aren't associated with universities, that are just freestanding medical schools, that will be first or second in the country in grants that we receive from the NIH, that among all NIH recipients, including the big universities, in dollars per square foot of laboratory space, we're any year first, second, or third. And I take great pride in all the faculty who have been elected to the National Academy of Science and Medicine now. I think that, you know, these are just wonderful things that, you know, when I can't sleep at night, I can think about and helps me fall asleep.
Oh, fantastic. You touched on this earlier, and I'll ask you it because you're a behavioral health or psychiatrist by background. Behavioral health has become a bigger part of the American landscape. It's getting much more attention than it did 5 to 10 years ago. Talk for a moment about the big changes you see in behavioral health. And you already mentioned one, which was the movement away from completely focused on talk therapy and those kinds of things to a mix of understanding the biology of psychiatry as well. But talk for a moment about big changes in behavioral health.
Well, the biggest change that we have to face, that we're only beginning now to identify and try to rectify, is that it's a hugely underfunded area. Psychiatry services traditionally lose money. Psychiatry, because of the sicker you are, the less able you are to have employment, and because of that, the more likely you are to be on Medicaid, means that fewer and fewer physicians are available to even take care of you. So unless we recognize that the nature of this disease causes people to not have the financial capacity that they need to get the care that is necessary, this epidemic is never going to be controlled. So I'm looking forward to a recognition that parity, commercial parity, that we're talking about, when we talk about insurance companies should pay the same for a medical interview as they do for a psychiatric interview of a patient, should recognize that there aren't that many people with really serious psychiatric disease who have commercial insurance, and that what we have to do is let this extend into what we're paying in Medicaid rates.
Certainly. So huge underfunding in it, and something that's starting to be recognized, I think, more and more nationally. There's huge underfunding in behavioral health. One last question, Dr. Davis. Top three priorities for you for Mount Sinai. What are the top three priorities as you look in the next 6 to 12 months?
Oh, well, getting patients to come back, getting patients to feel comfortable that hospitals are safe and they shouldn't defer their care. That's our first priority. Our second priority is, in the event of in New York a second wave, that we're completely prepared. And we are, and we would never be like the first wave, which was unbelievable. But if we have a little blip up, that we're utterly prepared in every way, from PPE to drugs to where we would be able to isolate the patients. And the third is the recognition that no matter how hard I try, no matter how good our marketing is, there will still be people who are going to be afraid to come back. And with unemployment in New York State at about 20%, the number of Medicaid patients we're going to have will increase enormously. The number of uncompensated patients we have will increase enormously. And what all that equals is a real hit on our top line revenues. So that my next priority is controlling expenses, limiting expenses, and managing through what is going to be a very tough fiscal environment.
And why could it be a tough fiscal environment for really a few years right now? Because it'll take time for people to come back. People are out of jobs as well. They have to be confident to come back and also having to possibly deal with another wave. The point you made on being better prepared, I do hear this from your colleagues in California and Texas and Arizona and Florida, that they feel because of what they've learned from the lessons they've gotten from their colleagues in New York, Massachusetts, Illinois, and other places, that they're far better prepared to deal with their COVID populations now than they would have been 3 to 5 months ago, which seems like a very good sign in terms of, like, no great signs, but that's a good sign, at least a little bit easier to manage than it was, and still very difficult than it was 3 to 5 months ago.
Clearly it is. When we began, when the COVID epidemic hit New York, we were all scrounging like crazy to find PPE. And our good fortune was that we had academic partners and affiliations with hospitals in China. And because of that, and because of what we saw happening in Wuhan, we had been buying supplies in China. We had 5.5 tons of PPE waiting to be delivered to us from an airport in China just as this hit New York, so that our system was able to meet the PPE demands where some of my colleagues were running around worrying like crazy about whether they were going to run out of ventilators or gowns or masks. We never had that problem. But going forward now, if there's another wave, we certainly won't have that problem.
Well, that's fantastic. I hear that more and more, that people feel better prepared, more intelligent prepared, more ready to deal with this than they did before, and let's hope that's the case. Dr. Davis, it's an unusual pleasure to get to visit with you. You've had this remarkable career, and you've done just a remarkable job with Mount Sinai. It's really an unparalleled achievement what you've had there. So thank you very much for your time today and for what
you
do. Just magnificent.
Well, thank you for your very kind words. And anytime you need me, I'll be available to your podcast.
What a pleasure, Ken. Thank you so much, Dr. Davis.
Bye-bye.